Hi, and welcome to the Great South African Tales podcast. I'm Dave Charles, and if you enjoy a good story that is short enough to listen to in one go, and if you have South African roots or are interested in aspects of an era that is almost lost, you'll love what I've selected to read for you. The slyly simple stories of the unforgiving South African Transvaal reveal a little described world of Afrikaner life in the late 19th century. In Mafeking Road, the story that you're about to hear, Wim Skulk Lorentz explains the art of good storytelling and the importance of what to leave out rather than what to put into it. He illustrates this by telling the achingly poignant story of Floris, the last of the Van Barnevelts, and the son he lost in the Second World War. Mafeking Road. When people ask me, as they often do, how it is that I can tell the best stories of anybody in the Transvaal, Scott Lawrence said modestly, then I explain to them that I just learn through observing the way the world has with men and women. When I say this, they nod their heads wisely and say that they understand, and I nod my head wisely also, and that seems to satisfy them. But the thing I say to them is a lie, of course. For it is not the story that counts. What matters is the way you tell it. The most important thing is to know just at what moment you must knock out your pipe on your veldschoen, and at what stage of the story you must start talking about the school committee at Droogveld. Another necessary thing to know is what part of the story to leave out. And you can never learn these things. Look at Floris, the last of the Van Barnevelts. There is no doubt that he had a good story and that he should have been able to get people to listen to it. And yet nobody took any notice of him or the things he had to say just because he couldn't tell the story properly. Accordingly, it made me sad whenever I listened to him talk, for I could tell just where he went wrong. He never knew the moment at which to knock the ash out of his pipe. He always mentioned his opinion of the Droogveld School Committee in the wrong place. And, what was still worse, he didn't know what part of the story to leave out. And it was no use my trying to teach him, because, as I've said, this is the thing that you can never learn. And so, each time he had told his story, I would see him turn away from me with a look of doom on his face and walk slowly down the road, stoop-shouldered, the last of the Van Barnevelts. On the wall of Floris's voorkamer is a long family tree of the Van Barnevelts. You can see it there for yourself. It goes back for over 200 years to the Van Barnevelts of Amsterdam. At one time it went back even further, but that was before the white ants started on the top part of it and ate away quite a lot of the Van Barnevelts. Nevertheless, if you look at the list, you'll notice that at the bottom, under Floris's own name, there is the last entry, Stephanus, and behind the name, Stephanus, between two bent strokes, you will read the words, Obiit Mafeking. At the outbreak of the Second World War, Floris van Barnevelt was a widower, with one son, Stephanus, who was aged 17. The commando from our part of the Transvaal set off very cheerfully. We made a fine show with our horses, our white hats, our bandoliers, and the sun shining on the barrels of our Mausers. Young Stephanus van Barneveld was the gayest of us all, but he said that there was one thing he didn't like about the war, and that was that in the end we would have to go over the sea. He said that after we'd invaded the whole of the Cape, our commando would have to go on a ship and invade England also. But we didn't go overseas just then. Instead, our Feldcornet told us that the burghers from our part had been ordered to join the big commando that was lying at Mafeking. We had to go and shoot a man there called Baden-Powell. We rode steadily on into the west. After a while, we noticed that our Feldcornet frequently got off his horse and engaged in conversation with passing people, leading them some distance from the roadside and speaking earnestly to them. Of course, it was right that our Feldcornet should explain to the people passing by that it was wartime now and that the Republic expected every passerby to stop smoking so much dacha and to think seriously about what was going on. But we noticed that each time at the end of the conversation, the passerby would point towards something, and that our felt cornet would take much pains to follow the direction of the passerby's finger. Of course we understood then what it was all about. Our felt cornet was a young fellow, and he was shy to let us see that he didn't know the way to Mafeking. Somehow after that, we didn't have much confidence in our felt cornet. After a few days, we got to Mafeking. We stayed there a long while until the English troops came up and relieved the place. We left then. We left quickly. The English troops had brought a lot of artillery with them, and if we had difficulty in finding the road to Mafeking, we had no difficulty in finding the road away from Mafeking. And this time, our felt cornet did not need passers-by either to point their fingers to where we had to go, even though we did a lot of traveling in the night. Long afterwards, I spoke to an Englishman about this. He said it gave him a queer feeling to hear about the other side of Mafeking. He said there'd been very great rejoicings in England when Mafeking was relieved, and it was strange to think of the other aspect of it, of a defeated country and of broken columns blundering through the dark. I remember many things that happened on the way back from Mafeking. There was no moon, and the stars shone down fitfully on the road that was full of guns and frightened horses and desperate men. The veld throbbed with the hoofbeats of baffled commandos. The stars looked down on scenes that told somberly of a nation's ruin. They looked on the muzzles of the Mosers that had failed the Transvaal for the first time. Of course, as a burgher of the Republic, I knew what my duty was, and that it was to get as far away as I could from the place where, in the sunset, I had last seen English artillery. The other burghers knew their duty also. Our commandants and felt cornets had to give very few orders. Nevertheless, though I rode very fast, there was one young man who rode still faster. He kept ahead of me all the time. He rode as a burgher should ride when there were many stray bullets flying, with his head well down and his arms almost around his horse's neck. It was Stephanus, young son of Floris van Barneveld. There was much grumbling and dissatisfaction sometime afterwards when our leaders started making an effort to get the commandos in order again. In the end, they managed to get us to halt, but most of us felt that this was a foolish thing to do, especially as there was still a lot of firing going on all over the place in haphazard fashion, and we couldn't tell how far the English had followed us in the dark. Furthermore, the commandos had scattered in so many different directions that it seemed hopeless to try to get them together again until after the war. Stephanus and I dismounted and stood by our horses. Soon there was a large body of men around us. Their figures looked strange and shadowy in the starlight. Some of them stood by their horses, others sat on the grass by the roadside. "Fast on, burghers, fast on," came the commands of our officers. And all the time we could still hear what sounded a lot like Lyddite. It seemed foolish to be waiting there. "The next thing they'll want," Stephanus van Barneveld said, "is for us to go back to Mafeking. Perhaps our commandant has left his tobacco pouch behind there." Some of us laughed at this remark, but Floris, who had not dismounted, said that Stephanus ought to be ashamed of himself for talking like that. From what we could see of Floris in the gloom, he looked quite impressive, sitting very straight in the saddle with the stars shining on his beard and rifle. "If the felt cornet told me to go back to Mafeking," Floris said, "I would go back." "That is how a burgher should talk," the felt cornet said, feeling flattered. For he had had very little authority since the time we found out what he was talking to passers-by for. "I wouldn't go back to Mafeking for anybody," Stephanus replied, "unless maybe it's to hand myself over to the English." "We can shoot you for doing that," the felt cornet said. "It's contrary to military law." "I wish I knew something about military law," Stephanus answered. "Then I would draw up a peace treaty between Stephanus van Barneveld and England." Some men laughed again, but Floris shook his head sadly. He said the van Barnevelds had fought bravely against Spain in a war that lasted 80 years. Suddenly, out of the darkness, there came a sharp rattle of musketry, and our men started getting uneasy again. But the sound of the firing decided Stephanus. He jumped on his horse quickly. I am turning back, he said. I am going to hands up to the English. No, no, don't go, the Falkornet called him lamely. Or at least wait until the morning. They may shoot you in the dark by mistake. As I have said, the Falkornet had very little authority. 2 days passed before we again saw Floris van Barneveld. He was in a very worn and troubled state, and he said that it had been very hard for him to find his way back to us. You should have asked the passers-by, one of the number said with a laugh. All of the passers-by know our Falkornet. But Floris did not speak about what happened that night when we saw him riding out under the starlight, following after his son and shouting at him to be a man and to fight for his country. Also, Floris did not mention Stephanus again, his son, who was not worthy to be a Van Barneveld. After that, we got separated. Our Falkornet was the first to be taken prisoner, and I often felt that he must be very lonely on St. Helena, because there were no passers-by from whom he could ask the way out of the barbed wire camp. Then at last, our leaders came together at Vereeniging, and peace was made. And we returned to our farms, relieved that the war was over, but with heavy hearts at the thought that it had all been for nothing, and over the Transvaal the Vier Clear would not wave again. And Floris van Barneveld put back in its place on the wall of the Voorkamer the copy of his family tree that he'd carried with him in his knapsack throughout the war. Then a new schoolmaster came to this part of the Marico, and after a long talk with Floris, the schoolmaster wrote behind Stephanus' name between two curved lines the two words that you can still read there, Obiit Mafeking. Consequently, if you ask any person here about what Obiit means, he is able to tell you right away that it is a foreign word and that it means to ride up to the English holding your Mauser in the air and with a white flag tied to it near the muzzle. But it was long afterwards that Floris van Barneveld started telling the story. And then they took no notice of him, and they wouldn't allow him to be nominated for the Durageveld School Committee on the grounds that a man must be wrong in the head to talk in such an irresponsible fashion. But I knew that Floris had a good story, and that its only fault was that he told it badly. He mentioned the Durageveld School Committee too soon, and he knocked the ash out of his pipe in the wrong place. And he always insisted on telling that part of the story that he should have left out.
Join us in the next episode of the Great South African Stories podcast series for another gem of a story from the Mafeking Road collection.